senior Iranian commander says the Islamic Republic will continue to enhance its defense capabilities as new combat speedboats join the Navy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears in court to formally respond to corruption charges. At a Myanmar, police use water cannon against protesters demanding the release of ex-leader Aung San Suu Kyi, detained during a coup d'etat last Monday. You're with World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting with some developments in Iran, some 300 new combat speedboats have joined the naval fleet of the IRGC, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, in the operation in the country's southern waters. Speedboats can carry out assault operations with different types of missiles and rockets. They can also support Navy divers. During a ceremony in the city of Bandar Abbas, IRGC's commander said that the Islamic Republic will continue to enhance its defense capability in the face of enemy threats. Major General Hossein Salami said that this includes enhancing potentialities in air, surface, and subsurface systems. The general noted that Iran's recent military accomplishments indicate the fact that a U.S. maximum pressure campaign has failed thanks to the Iranian people's steadfastness and resilience. Tehran says it's Washington that has to return to the 2015 nuclear deal which it withdrew from unilaterally.
Wait for the U.S. to return to the deal and fulfill all its commitments. If they do so, we will also immediately resume complying with the agreement. Iran is still part of the JCPOA, but it is the U.S. that left the deal.
Khatib Zadeh says that Tehran has scaled back its commitments in response to the failure of other signatories to fulfill their obligations. He said that the U.S. has the opportunity now to return to the agreement and compensate for its wrong policies. The spokesman also held a recent ruling by the International Court of Justice to take on Iran's bid to overturn U.S. sanctions. He called it a legal victory in international arena. The remarks came after the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution emphasized that the country's stance won't change as regards the JCPOA.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the country will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, is the name of the nuclear deal Iran clinched in 2015 with world powers, including the US. But America withdrew from the accord under former President Donald Trump and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. Now, the new president, Joe Biden, says the U.S. will return to the deal, but Iran must first return to full compliance. Iran rejects this, arguing that it was the U.S. that exited the accord and breached its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei says it is the definitive and irreversible policy of Iran that the U.S. should first lift its sanctions. The leader also says that it's Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has fulfilled all its commitments under the agreement. The leader's comments follow calls by some Western countries to renegotiate the Iran deal and expand it beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. We have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region. And this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now.
Iran has time and again stressed that the JCPOA is non-negotiable. The country rolled back some of its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after the U.S. pullout. Iran did so after the European countries in the JCPOA, namely France, Britain and Germany, failed to make up for the U.S. withdrawal. Tehran has repeatedly said its rolling back measures are fully reversible once other parties fulfill their commitments. Iran says the ball is now in U.S. court. It says President Biden should now decide on whether to continue the policies of his predecessor or choose a new path. Those policies by Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign have already been described as a failure, even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Now, in other news, the Iranian scientists say that the human trial of COV-PARS, the second indigenously developed coronavirus vaccine, will start next week. In a press conference, the scientists said that the vaccine's verification process will be carried out in several stages. We have talked to Mohammed Hussein Fallah Mehrabadi, the spokesman of the project, about the vaccine.
The vaccine produced by Razi Institute is recombinant protein vaccine, and it has been tested on animals, including rabbits and rats, and the African green monkey. So it has its safety has been tested, and we have been also going through its the effectiveness of its immunization in monkeys. So there are two dosages to be injected, and also there's a dosage for inhalation. There has been pre-trial studies, and 14 days after receiving the shot, the person will be immunized. We have the new design, in which case the person has to inhale the vaccine. So a person who is vaccinated in the form of injection, there is still the possibility that the transmission chain may not be cut off. So there's the spraying of the vaccine, and it activates the defensive system.
The Israeli Prime Minister appears in court to formally respond to corruption charges against him. Benjamin Netanyahu has pleaded not guilty to the charges. The Monday hearing marks the beginning of the trial proper, with subsequent sessions focused on testimony and evidence. A large crowd of protesters gathered outside the court in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Netanyahu was charged last year over allegations of accepting improper gifts and seeking to trade regulatory favor with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage. But he claims to be the victim of a witch hunt. The trial schedule may force him to appear in court multiple times a week. I talked to our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kendall, says that Israeli Prime Minister hopes that the upcoming elections will protect him during his corruption trial.
The trial is still going on. However, the judge would be hearing witnesses maybe in late February, and others are saying that the witnesses will come to court maybe after the Israeli elections, 6 weeks from now. That's why Netanyahu is trying to gain more time, according to experts. He's not afraid of the of his trial or the hearing, knowing that maybe the upcoming elections would save him. At the same time, those anti-Netanyahu policies, let's say, according to the Israeli media, Netanyahu's haters held a demonstration outside the court. They were demanding that he must be punished and not be the prime minister for another period of time. At the same time, his supporters were also appearing outside the court trying to defend Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the first Israeli prime minister to be facing such a trial while he is still the premier of the Israeli regime.
Palestinian human rights organizations have welcomed the International Criminal Court's ruling that its jurisdiction extends to Palestinian territories occupied by the Tel Aviv regime since 1967.
Palestinian human rights organizations have hailed the decision by the International Criminal Court, ICC, after affirming that the court has full territorial jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories, including the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, together with its partners, stressed that immediate action must be taken by ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda to investigate Israeli atrocities and ensure justice and accountability for Palestinian victims. For decades, the Israeli regime has been causing pain and suffering for Palestinians. it has waged three wars on the Gaza Strip and has kept the tiny enclave under a crippling blockade. Tel Aviv has also increased illegal settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem al-Quds.
This is a very important decision, and Palestinians have been waiting for it, because it might finally bring them justice after many years of Israeli occupation and crimes. The crimes have been systematic and taking place on a daily basis.
Families of war victims in Gaza say the ICC decision is a step in the right direction towards achieving justice. They demanded that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes.
Israel has killed 8 members of my family because it felt that it would get away with it. Today, we want justice for our loved ones.
The ICC must prosecute Israel for its war crimes during the last 3 wars on Gaza because of its forces killed and injured thousands of innocent and unarmed Palestinians, including my son.
For decades, the Israeli regime has demonstrated zero accountability to crimes perpetrated by its soldiers. Rights groups demand accountability mechanisms to ensure that Israeli perpetrators are brought to justice in accordance with international law. Experts say that Tel Aviv's crimes against Palestinians will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from the United States.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The Myanmar police used water cannon to disperse people protesting a military coup d'etat that led to the arrest of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. In the capital, Naypyidaw, the demonstrators chanted anti-coup slogans. They demand the immediate release of Suu Kyi, urging the military to hand power back to the elected politicians. Similar protests were held in Yangon and several other cities. Suu Kyi and key government officials were arrested by the military in a pre-dawn raid last week. A massive Himalayan glacier burst leaves a trail of death and destruction in northern India after crashing into a dam and causing huge flooding. The government has confirmed 18 deaths, while scores remain missing after the tragedy in the state of Uttarakhand on Sunday. At least 4 hydropower plants in the area were damaged, and 2 bridges washed away after flood waters forced their way through the Dali Ganga River Valley. Most of the missing are believed to be workers from those plants. The army has been deployed to help with rescue efforts. Authorities have also alerted people against rumors of another flood after some reports suggested a rise in water level. The European Organization for Human Rights has called for reopening the Sana'a International Airport. The rights group made a call at a press conference in the Yemeni capital. They then discussed the dire consequences of the continued closure of the airport and the siege imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia. Abu Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemeni officials and the European Organization for Human Rights have held a press conference aimed at renewing calls for reopening Sana'a International Airport. The rights group affirmed that the continued closure resulted in more loss of lives, killing patients who can't travel for treatment.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has exacerbated the human suffering, starting with the stoppage of airport workers who support their families and the inability of patients to travel for treatment, especially the elderly and children. This constitutes a real tragedy because patients are forced to travel to very remote governorates to reach an airport that works, and the roads are rough and deteriorate patients' condition.
The director of Sana'a International Airport said the closure is a major reason for the humanitarian crisis in the country, as it has turned the country into a prison, banning the patients from traveling for treatment.
The closure of Sana'a Airport turned Yemen into a large prison, which is a war crime because it led the country to a humanitarian catastrophe. The airport serves more than 11 governorates and is the only airport for these governorates. There are more than 100,000 patients who died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and there are still about 400,000 patients who are at risk of losing their lives, while some 25 to 30 patients die every day.
Yemenis have been suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis since Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 and imposed a siege that has fueled starvation in Yemen.
Human rights activists say that Sana'a Airport must be reopened to allow thousands of patients to get proper treatment as the first step to lift the siege imposed on the war-torn country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Another international TV news channel has been taken off the air in the UK. This time it was CGTN, funded by China. Ofcom's reasons and its works were justified, but in the face of who funds this channel and when other channels promote news and coverage against Ofcom's so-called principled guidelines, then this smacks up double standard.
On Thursday, UK media regulator Ofcom revoked the broadcasting license of Chinese network CGTN. Under UK broadcasting laws, organizations that hold broadcasting licenses may be state-funded, but must not be controlled by political bodies. Ofcom gave CGTN time to transfer its license to China Global Television Network Corporation. CGTN had asked for its license to be transferred to an entity called China Global Television Network Corporation, but in the end, the UK regulator claimed that it is not convinced that the new entity would be free from political meddling. This isn't the first time that Ofcom took an aim on the Chinese news channel. The UK regulator had previously accused CGTN of breaching impartiality standards with its coverage of Hong Kong protests. Ofcom accused CGTN of the same violations while covering separate incidents. The Chinese network rejects the accusations, saying that it provides global audiences with accurate and timely news coverage, as well as rich audiovisual services. CGTN said it was disappointed and expressed strong opposition to Ofcom's findings while defending its record as a professional media organization. The broadcaster said it complied with all local laws, adding that it would continue to promote understanding, communication, trust, and cooperation. China's foreign ministry also said that it firmly opposes the decision and accused the British government of blatant double standards and political oppression.
Ofcom has based an ideological prejudice, suppressed CGTN's broadcast in the UK on political grounds. It politicizes issues on a technical level, seriously hurts the survival of Chinese media, and seriously interferes with the normal exchanges between the two countries.
It's a political one. The things that they're accusing CGTN of doing are things that its own BBC, you know, there in the UK, is guilty of many times over. When you look at some of the complaints against CGTN, it's, you know, about things like its coverage of Hong Kong. But if we think about the BBC's coverage of Hong Kong, how one-sided it was, you know, if CGTN was operating in the UK and wanted to try to, you know, provide some balance to that narrative, they would have had to do things that might have seemed, you know, less than impartial.
The dispute between Ofcom and CGTN could ramp up tensions between London and Beijing, with some people calling on the Chinese government to expel British network BBC in return. China now warned against lodging complaints against the BBC. China's foreign ministry accused the British Broadcasting Corporation of pushing fake news in its COVID-19 reporting, demanding an apology.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
First revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
According to the policy, there has to be countries and political units in the Middle East region that enjoy five characteristics. First, they have to be weak. Second, they have to be hostile to one another, and they should not be able to unite. As a result, you saw that they followed the policy of strengthening Arab nationalism, Turkish nationalism, and Iranian nationalism for many years. Third, their rulers have to be politically obedient and given to the Western powers. Fourth, they have to be consumers from the economic point of view. That is to say, they have to spend on imports and communerism the money that they earn from selling their oil at a very low price so that the Western companies can boost their business. Fifth, they have to be scientifically backward, and they should not be given the permission to make scientific progress. These are just general points. It would really take a book to explain them.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, Allah.
How did they use to prevent scientific progress in our country and certain other countries? They wanted the nations of this region to blindly imitate the Europeans in cultural areas. They wanted the nation of the region to be completely superficial and settle for a kind of religion that is personal and possibly ceremonial. This was the picture that they had in mind, and they prepared policies to achieve this goal. Maybe Western strategists spent thousands of hours to study this issue. Maybe they spent thousands of hours to think about it and make plans. They deployed their agents in the Middle Eastern countries and used them to do what they wanted to do. This analysis can help us to appropriately understand Reza Shah's behavior, Mohammad Reza Shah's behavior, and the behavior of Turkey's Mustafa Kemal and many others. This was their plan, and they were successful.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Thank you.
The U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks in his first foreign policy speech included a handful of announcements and intentions, including Washington's decision to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia in order to avoid the current humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen to be worsened. Biden condemned the Saudi-led war on Yemen, saying it has created a humanitarian and a strategic catastrophe, and it has to end. Indeed, 6 years of war and blockade in Yemen has taken a heavy toll on the country. Thousands have lost their lives in the Saudi-led attacks, while millions lost their homes or abandoned them to run away from the horrors of war. But the degree which the U.S. was involved was confirmed by a New York Times article, facts that were not well known up to this point. The article stated that Saudi F-15 jets were not only serviced by American mechanics, but also American technicians upgraded the targeting software and other classified technology. Saudi commanders sat with American military officials who provided intelligence and tactical advice, which included dropping American bombs. UNICEF has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 24 million in dire need of help. Washington has been the biggest arms supplier of Riyadh during the first 5 years of Yemen war, as it provided three-quarters of Saudi's arms imports. For Washington, halting arms sales to Riyadh is not a cost-effective decision, even though Biden has promised to do so. It appears that Biden is using a double standard policy. He claims he wants to end the Yemen war and stop selling arms to Riyadh, which means losing billions of dollars of income. Contrastingly, he promises to provide defensive support for Saudi Arabia to defend itself against Yemeni attacks. The Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to Biden's speech, saying that Yemenis do not trust Washington's words on ending the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Ansarullah also says the establishment of real peace in the war-hit country is only possible if the Saudi-led attacks and blockade end, signaling that Yemen seeks real action to solve the problem, not just words. Despite Joe Biden's show of reversing former U.S. President Donald Trump's foreign policy, it seems Biden is using a hypocritical policy in dealing with Yemen war.
Well, the situation in terms of Saudi Arabia and the war against Yemen has been going on now for several years. I don't think the Biden position is really any different, essentially, from the point of view of the Yemeni people who have been suffering. We have to remember, of course, this kind of terminology that's used about military hardware being used for defensive capabilities. No military hardware is made for defensive capabilities if it's being used against a population as we've seen in the Yemen. So I don't anticipate there's going to be that much of a difference in terms of this policy decision from the point of view of whether the United States is supporting the Saudi regime or not.
In his first foreign policy speech, the U.S. President Joe Biden indicated that his administration will deal with Russia differently, saying the time of the U.S. rolling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions, including election interference and cyber attacks, is over, and that Washington will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia. The U.S. president made it clear that Washington is keen on pushing back Russian threats and human rights abuse. Biden also condemned detention of the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and called for his immediate release. He also urged Moscow to hold using force against opposition protests. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while the Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. It also backed police actions against what it calls unauthorized rallies. Biden made those remarks while his administration moved quickly to extend the New START arms control treaty with Russia, The extension of this landmark arms control treaty will limit the number of nuclear missiles and warheads each country can deploy. But how could Moscow and Washington reach this agreement despite their disagreements?
Their concern is China rather than Russia. For the United States, the situation in Russia is a bit of a sideshow. They're not really sure what's happening on the ground. We know there are elements from the United States who are trying to destabilize Russia as we speak, and the situation with Navalny is very fluid indeed. So I think the Russians are, in a sense, going about their business, and the Americans are waiting in the wings to see what happens. So I think really in terms of geopolitics, the Biden administration is much more concerned with China as a superpower, as what it would define as a challenge to U.S. hegemony. And I think with the situation in Russia, United States will be playing both sides of the game.
While the U.S. President Joe Biden claimed his administration policy to deal with Russia's foreign policy is head-on, Biden has shown a double-standard approach. On one hand, he denounces Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny's arrest, but on a wider scale, he rushes to reach an accord with Kremlin. With this hypocrisy in Washington's foreign policy, where does Biden's policy with Russia lie?
Italians are in the midst of a multifaceted crisis. Italy has been hit particularly hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of the highest death tolls in the world. The Eurozone's third biggest economy is meanwhile suffering from one of the worst downturns in decades. And now, political chaos triggered by the collapse of the coalition government last week is making the situation much worse. Some say it is the most perilous time for Italians since World War II. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has brought in this man to try to resolve the situation and put Italy on the right track, Mario Draghi, former head of the European Central Bank. He received a mandate earlier this week to form a new coalition government. Hopes are high for Draghi to find a way forward.
Well, Mario Draghi certainly has the experience of high-level politics and is broadly respected by both politicians and by the population. The man who famously said, whatever it takes, is broadly credited with saving the euro following the last recession in 2008-2009 and the subsequent sovereign debt crisis. So he definitely has the respect of people. Whether that then can translate into forming but maintaining a government in Italy remains to be seen.
Italy's financial markets reacted positively to a sudden arrival on the political scene. The star technocrat is extremely efficient under pressure. He steered the Eurozone through the financial crisis during his tenure as president of the European Central Bank. He is widely credited with saving both the Eurozone and the euro currency. His performance as the president of the European Central Bank became a source of national pride for Italians. The 73-year-old economist now has broad support among many major political parties. But Italian politics is a dangerous place, especially for technocrats and economists like him. After losing his Senate majority last week, Giuseppe Conte resigned as Italian prime minister. The crisis was triggered after a decision by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to withdraw his liberal Italia Viva party out of the centrist coalition government. Renzi was opposed to Conte's plan to spend well over 200 billion euros of EU recovery funds on the coronavirus crisis. Observers believe doubts about the outgoing government's ability to properly spend the money led to its collapse. But Draghi is widely believed to be capable of handling such sums because he is an experienced economist. But has he really got what it takes to be Italy's next prime minister? He is right now trying to unite as many political parties as he can. The former ECB chief wants to secure broad cross-party support because of the daunting challenges facing Italy.
Italy is particularly difficult to form and maintain a government. The main reason is that it usually requires a fairly broad coalition of a number of different political parties. What that does is put together people with competing ideologies or competing and differing views of how the government and indeed the country should be run. This creates a situation where the smaller parties actually have disproportionate amount of power.
So far, the center-left Democratic Party has given him its backing. Renzi's Italia Viva Party has pledged unconditional support for Draghi. Center-right Forza Italia, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, also suggested that it might be ready to help out. But the right-wing league insists that it will not support a government backed by Five Star. All eyes are on Draghi now. He is considered a hero for the Eurozone. Can he unite the Italians at this time of crisis?
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved its attack of forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
Well, it uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eklima Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, and most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of a speech delivered on January 16th, 1980, by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini. Subject, Most Superior Migration from Carnal Desires. Migration carries a great meaning. Of all migrations, the migration from self-conceit and riding of selfishness, egoism, and migration from one's self towards God is the greatest of migrations. The migration of Prophet from Mecca to Medina aimed to show men the way of migration from one's self towards Allah. Teachings of Prophets are for this migration so that we migrate from darkness, gloom, selfishness, carnal passions towards Allah, and defecting from ourselves and our satanic desire and turn towards Allah, the Almighty.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. We were talking about the relationship between the religion and politics in viewpoints of Imam Khomeini and how Imam Khomeini thinks about the politics and religion. Being a religious person, he worked perfectly in the field of politics as well, so that he could have this revolution, the revolution that we know as an Islamic revolution, not a Shi'i revolution, not a Sunni revolution. It's an Islamic revolution, and that's what we can see from the Imam Khomeini. It's because of his struggles. Now, apart from this, Imam Khomeini also believed that the society stands in need of an acceptable government at all times, including the time of occultation. Now, why he was very much emphasizing on the Islamic state, why he is very much emphasizing on the government, Islamic government, being a religious person, it's because we have a hadith, and that hadith says, "An-nasu ala dini mulukihim." The people follow the religion of their leaders. The people follow the religion of their chiefs. So if the chief or the leader is the pure person, then the people will go towards the perfection.
ای گذشت بزام در ره هدا هر زمان میرسد از تو این ندا ای از ایران مستضعفان بپا بود شاه تو به راه حق بیران زما تو را درود زما تو را سلام خمینی ای امام خمینی ای امام خمینی ای امام خمینی ای امام.
He has mentioned that the Islam has come to purify mankind. If an Islamic state, the head of state is a purified person, he can take these people towards the purification. Being a Shia Muslim, we believe that Imam Mahdi, when he will come, he will bring the governorship of the justice. He will bring justice into the world. Why? Because he, being a leader, is the most just person, is the most just person on the earth. And that's why everyone will follow him. Imam Khomeini also had the same idea. He said, at the time of occultation, if Imam is not there, then his representative should be there, his successor, the one who Imam himself has introduced. And Imam has said that at the time of occultation, you must follow the scholars, the fuqaha, that are the representative of me. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to understand and to follow the teachings of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavitah Weiwa. On this week's show, we'll be looking at the economic war between China and the U.S., particularly focusing on the tussle for the top of the world's largest economy ladder, something that appears to be about to change. Will the impact of the COVID-19 virus has, of course, played its part in the world's economy, yet it seems that the recovery time from the depression caused is something that could be a factor in just how individual economies pick up again, with China seeming to lead the way as it bounces back from the financial impact seen in the year 2020. But it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that has seen economies rise and fall. As from back in 2010, the Chinese economy began to exponentially gain on the U.S. economy, chart from the CEBR World Economic League table, which also shows that by the year 2028, the Chinese economy will catch up with and surpass that of the U.S. Naturally, China excels when it comes to foreign exports and is hence a major factor in why it is able to recover so well. Yet, as things settle down in China, it is the domestic market that also sees China take an advantage over the U.S. As we can see in this chart over here, retail sales in China are rising faster than those of the U.S., which is still seeing lockdowns and closures prevent its economy recovering as fast as that of China. Now, in order to take a deeper look into just what is happening on the Sino-American economic front, let's get straight into our first report, which addresses the issue on a deeper level.
The race is on for the world's largest economy as global nations emerge slowly but surely from the devastating effect of the COVID-19 pandemic that rocked economies and cost lives around the world. The two current largest global economies, the United States of America and China, remain locked in horns as per prior to the arrival of the virus. But now it seems, as the world sets out its agenda to recover, is just how fast each nation will be back on its feet, and is something that will no doubt determine just how quickly China catch up with and eventually surpass the US as the world's largest economy.
Before the pandemic, there was clear evidence that China was going to surpass the US in terms of its size of GDP. And on some measures, or GDP measured as purchasing power parity, China had already done that in 2019. So the pandemic itself wasn't the reason for this. This was already happening.
Whereas China has demonstrated that it's been able to successfully return into the black following the pandemic, with factories and shops opening up again and lockdown measures all but eradicated, the opposite is true in the United States, which is still seeing its economy struggle to return to pre-pandemic levels, and is something that will no doubt hinder the rate in which they finally do recover. Furthermore, the US, under the leadership of ex-President Donald Trump, made it a daily routine to put America first, making sure that its internal economy was the priority, almost ignoring the notion of multilateral trade, something that China has done with great interest, with examples being the Global Belt and Road Initiative and the signing of the regional RCEP agreement, which saw China boost its regional economic sway.
Multilateral trade systems is the answer to keeping to promoting world GDP and also in forestalling any kind of military or economic frictions. So, yes, I think trade is the solution to many of the world's problems. The more interdependent we become, the less likely we want to start fighting each other.
With predictions suggesting that the US and China will meet economic parity in 2028, the world, and in particular the US, will be keeping a keen eye on other emerging economic powers, such as India and Russia, as they edge their way up the table, potentially one day pushing the US further down the economic leaderboard.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. Mahan, welcome.
Pleasure.
And we have our special guest, Ming Du. He's a professor of Chinese law and trade and current director of the Center for Chinese Law and Policy at Durham University. Professor, many thanks for being with us today. First up, the U.S. and China. They're jostling for the top spot as the world's largest economy. Now, are we set to see a change in the status quo, do you think? Or is the global financial complex on a radically different route inspired by recent global events?
Thank you for having me today, Kavi. My points to your question are basically two points. First, I think China's economic growth is unstoppable. Barring any major disruptions in international relations, I think China is on its path to the number one economy in the world. But that being said, we should not underestimate the U.S. resilience. Given the historical examples, and U.S. has gone through some even worse major disruption, but somehow it recovered. So I think China is going to be number one, but it may take a little bit of time for China to achieve that spot. Thank you.
Well, Mahan, one of the main reasons that China seems to be catching up with Americans in terms of at least their GDP growth rate, where it counts is the fact that they seem to have emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people are talking about that much more quicker and more efficiently than the U.S. has. And, of course, this is being reflected in the economy. Do you think that the U.S. mismanagement is, in essence, the main reason for the Chinese exponential growth rates?
I think the key word here is resilience. The Chinese economy, and more broadly, the Chinese state and its society, just far more robust and resilient than their Western counterparts. I mean, let's face it, the West just fell apart in the face of this pandemic. Look at the UK, for instance. It has the highest death rate per capita in the world. The US is in disarray in terms of COVID-19, but China, where the virus supposedly originated from, has dealt incredibly well. It suppressed it very early on because it's a much more cohesive country. State and society work very well together.
This particular entry over here talks about how the first country hit by COVID-19, and it says it controlled the disease, but it did not need to repeat economically paralyzing lockdowns as European countries have done. So that, I think that's another important point here in terms of the lockdown, repeated lockdowns.
That speaks to preparedness, both on the part of the state and also on the part of society to accept very harsh measures very early on to get on top of a problem. The problem in the West, specifically Western Europe and North America, is that the society and the state were not in sync.